Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. Today, for our lecture, Madam, if I could interrupt you for a moment. Today, for our lecture, we have a great man. We have a person whom I think I could justify described as the preeminent professor of politics, not only in the his home country of the United Kingdom, but around the world. He is a very unusual professor of politics from many points of view. One is that he not only has had one original thought, but has had several original thoughts, which is unusual in itself. The other unusual feature of his work is that he believes quite justifiably that his original thoughts can be conveyed with brevity, and he does not write long and turgid works of political science. He writes very brief and very inspiring works. In 1962, he published a book called In Defence of Politics, a brief little book which has become a great classic. It's one of those works that will be around in 100 years' time and 200 years' time. Perhaps the greatest tribute to its evidence is that it was circulated in illegally, surreptitiously typed copies in the old Soviet Union. And it's gone through several editions, and it is, as I say, a great classic of political science. In 1964, he published another brief book called Reform of Parliament, which became the Bible of people who thought that Parliament should be reformed and that Westminster-type parliaments should be doing something other than shouting and screaming at each other all the time. And a lot of parliaments around the world have sought to introduce the sorts of measures that he set out in that book. In 1973, he published another very brief little book, which is called Basic Forms of Government, which is a very, very penetrating piece of work, which replaced Aristotle's classification of forms of government. But he's a man who's very much focused on the future, and particularly future constitutional and political developments. Today, he's going to speak to us about strange things have been going on in the United Kingdom in recent times, particularly the emergence of something which has been called quasi-federalism with parliaments in Scotland and Wales. So he's going to enlighten us on that subject and what this might ultimately lead to. Please welcome Professor Sir Bernard Crick.
Said that Lord Rosebery once dreamt that he was giving a speech on the floor of the House of Lords, and he woke up and by God he was. I feel Mr. Evans, as a guest of the Australian Senate, rather like that. A surprising invitation, and here I am. Your introduction gives me more honour than I deserve. I saw one or two of my old friends and colleagues in political science here, and I could see them grinning at thinking that this loose cannon was the most preeminent. But still, if you praise me more than I deserve, as the audience will discover in a few minutes, I still feel extremely honoured to be here. Just two preliminary remarks, as it were, scene setting. Back home, I've sometimes had to remind leaders of the new immigrant communities, sometimes very much self-styled leaders, by the way, that's one of the difficulties, as well as foreigners, that the United Kingdom has, after all, been a multinational state ever since 1707, the time of the Act of Union between England and Scotland, and it's been a multicultural state ever since the Industrial Revolution brought first large numbers of poor Irish immigrants into the cities of England and Scotland. They didn't all go to the United States or Australia. and later largish numbers of Jews, poor Jews again, fleeing persecution from Tsarist Russia. And they've been around for quite a long time, and most of them have not lost a sense of separate identity, though they are clearly and usually quite happily British citizens. Well, it used to be said of the Irish question in British politics that every time somebody came up with an answer, the question was changed, like a surreal citizenship examination conducted online. Now we Brits are not sure if it is a Scottish question, that Scottish politics has become so radically different from English, or an English question, that the traditional constitution of the United Kingdom, based on the English doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty, whether that no longer works in modern conditions, are certainly showing great signs of strain. The Scotland Act, 1998, gave substantial devolved powers to a Scottish Parliament, and, as Harry Evans has said, some students of politics have called it quasi-federalism. But of course it's not real federalism. There's no federal document, there's no constitutional court. Now, rather strangely, historically, federalism was good. So the British government thought was good for nearly all the former colonies, but not for the homeland itself. Indeed, somebody must have looked at a map in the old colonial office in the 19th century and noticed that New Zealand had a North and a South Island, so proposed federalism there and nearly provoked a rebellion. The idea of having three levels of government rather than two or none was not very attractive. Back in 1703 to 1707, when the Scots debated what were to be the terms of the Act of Union, the negotiation, the bargain, they were well aware that the English intended and got not just a union, which had a very vague sense in those days, but an incorporating union. The old Scottish Parliament was a single-chamber feudal institution with a purported balance of the three estates of the aristocracy, the church, and the merchant cities. But incorporating union meant being subsumed with minimal representation into an unchanged Westminster Parliament, which was already asserting a doctrine of omnicompetent sovereignty. But even then, it's necessary to remind ourselves, all was not as it seemed. The Scots drove a pretty hard bargain, so anxious were the English to shut out, in the middle of the wars in Europe against France, any possibility of the French allying with those Jacobite Scots who, to keep independence, would break from the Protestant succession and restore the committedly Catholic House of Stuart. The negotiations over union left the Kirk, the Presbyterian Church, as the established church in Scotland, the end of Episcopalian dominance. In constitutional law, the Queen changes her religion when she crosses the border, not the protector of the Church of England or the head of the Church of England, but then the head of the Presbyterian Church. So she opens them once a year and gives them tea, and that's that, fortunately. And Scotland gained entry into the protective commercial system of the first British Empire. And the treaty, or the Act of Union, lots of Scots still call it the Treaty of Union, left their legal system intact and all local administration, which after all was the main presence of government in those days, in Scottish hands. Scottish opponents of the Act of Union in those days said that the Westminster Parliament would use its power and sovereignty to change the terms of, as I've said, what they called the Treaty of Union. English MPs thought the same, who believed that their ministers had conceded far too much. But this was a misunderstanding of the nature of sovereignty and power. Legal possibilities did not correspond with actual political power. Political considerations always dominated. The English had no motive for trying to anglicise Scotland. As long as Scotland was safe from adopting their own alternative monarch, and as long as it was safe from the possibility of French dominance, they were virtually left to govern themselves. And of course, in a very real sense, this continued, as I'll be showing, even to today, even before the Devolution Act of 1998. If England had used its superior power to impose English institutions on Scotland, it would have provoked the very thing that made it want union, civil war with eventual French intervention. Oh dear, forgive all this dehydrated theory and potted history. You have invited a professor, so you'll have to get you've got a bit of that as background. But two deeply rooted political points emerge from this that are fundamental to the possibility of the breakup of the Union today. Firstly, the Scotland Act of 1998 did not arise from considerations of constitutional or even democratic theory, but what was thought by the Labour government to be sheer political necessity to halt the growth of separatist nationalism in Scotland. Tony Blair was no believer in devolution at all, but he was aware that Labour's majority in the House of Commons contained 56 MPs from Scottish seats. There could easily come a time with a first-past-the-post system when a majority at all might depend on them, even if in 1997 no Conservative MPs were returned from Scottish constituencies. A Tory-free zone, we all rejoiced or joked. Quibbling in Cabinet about the precise terms of the 98 Act stopped when the Secretary of State for Scotland, the late Donald Dewar, told his colleagues tersely, so my spies from the Cabinet told me, that if real powers were not granted, the Nats would sweep the board in parliamentary elections. But the real powers were actually the powers that were there already. The Scottish office controlled education, it controlled transport, it controlled the law. There was administrative devolution, but not political or democratic devolution. So a lot of the agitation in Scotland was not simply nationalist agitation. It was, like that of my late friend, the late John McIntosh, democratic agitation. There is all this government almost already in Scotland, almost completely uncontrolled. Westminster MPs were bored out of their hides at the idea of attending the Scottish Grand Committee on Friday mornings or whenever it met, that kind of thing. Dewar was a very great man in that sense, that he just put the issue as briefly and as harshly as he could, and so the Cabinet came round. He was a great loss. When the Queen opened the Scottish Parliament finally, there was a marvellous picture emerged on the television or to the crowds of the Queen walking out with dignity and alongside her the tall, lanky Donald Dewar with his hands in his pockets chatting to her as if he was talking familiarly to a constituent. That was very beautiful. And Sir David Steele, as the presiding officer of the Scottish Assembly, beginning his speech, "Madam, we welcome you to our assembly." But the second historical consequence of the concessions in and around the 1707 Act of Union was that Scottish national identity and consciousness was not affected. Even nationalist historians note this. There was no English attempt to anglicise Scotland in the way that, just by way of comparison, the French attempted to turn their colonies into francophone, French-speaking, culturally French entities. National historians who lament, the nationalist historians who lament the ending of the old Scottish Parliament, fail to see that the Kirk was the great carrier of national tradition and identity, far more than the aristocratic Parliament. English threats and bribery were certainly there in the negotiations, but they were aimed simply at parliamentary unity and at maintaining the unity of the crowns, not at anglicising Scotland. When I first began to follow Scottish politics closely about 30 years ago, Dr. Johnson said, "The man who was tired of London is tired of life." Well, I got tired of London and found a Scottish lassie and got involved in the Scottish devolution cause. Many, many times I heard on platforms a cry, "If we do not have our own parliament again, we will lose our national identity." And I began to see that that was absolute great nonsense. The very people who were saying it were so very, very Scottish. Whether or not they were separatist nationalists or simply full of a national resolve to get the already devolved institutions of government under democratic control and accountability. So under Dewar, as I've said, the drafting of the 1990 Act was relatively simple compared to its defeated predecessor in 1997. The existing powers of the Secretary of State and the Scottish Office were devolved to the Scottish Parliament. The reserved powers remaining with Westminster were foreign affairs, levels of social service benefits, and taxation. Scotland receives a block grant according to something called the Barnett Formula. Education, local government, the legal code, and administration remained as before in Scottish hands, as well as the administration of the National Health Service. There was one peculiar but politically highly important exception, which I must, in all honesty, mention. Westminster reserved to itself the power to legislate on abortion. The government benignly wished to save the Labour Party in Scotland from tearing itself apart. However, while the extraordinary flexibility of the United Kingdom Constitution allowed such an extraordinary constitutional change, as later, with different powers and institutions for Wales and Northern Ireland too, the ad hoc political decision had unforeseen and unpremeditated consequences, quite inconsistent with established parliamentary practice. Or, in Burns's famous words, "the best laid schemes are mason men act oft gang aglar." The most obvious is the so-called West Lothian question. Any Scottish MP at Westminster, say from West Lothian, can vote on any old legislation affecting England. But MPs with seats in the rest of the United Kingdom, England, Wales, or from Northern Ireland, predominantly English, of course, cannot vote or debate on matters devolved to the Scottish Parliament. Not surprisingly, Conservative MPs, who now have one seat in Scotland at least, are less than happy. And most of the London press agitate aggressively about this, almost Scotophobic, even though they rarely, if ever, report on actual Scottish politics. Not one newspaper increased its staff in Scotland, or very few newspapers actually had a separate staff in Scotland. They just rewrite the Reuters report. And the Reuters man, a friend of mine whom I first met in South Africa, is retired and is a part-timer. The two systems are drifting apart in mutual incomprehension. Some conservatives now favour an English parliament. The conservative leader has had to deny that this is his party's policy. But it's so much discussed that he's had to deny it. While some even favour, somewhat discreetly as yet, allowing Scotland to secede, thus a permanent Conservative majority at Westminster. Another unintended consequence of piecemeal and ad hoc constitutional reform was that while the Scotland Act brought in proportional representation in Scotland, deliberately intended to, by the Labour Party even, to create a lasting Labour Lib Dem coalition so as to contain the Scottish National Party. The Labour Party lost and decided to give up its long-held advantage in a single, in a first-past-the-post system out of fear that the Nationalists might benefit from the exaggerated swings you get in a first-past-the-post system. The unintended consequence, of course, the SNP is now the largest party at Holyrood and has formed a minority government. The Lib Dems had had enough of being bossed about by Labour in the previous coalition, and they decided to stand alone, and that let the SNP in. Although on the local government level, there are now only two local governments, Glasgow and I think it's Dundee, that are controlled by the Labour Party. Otherwise, they are Lib Dem nationalist coalitions, usually with the nationalists in the driving seat. But the SNP became the largest party, and you really must trust my judgment on this, because it is rather surprising, not for its still strongly professed policy of independence in Europe. That's their slogan, not just independence, but independence in Europe. That's meant to be reassuring, by the way. Which only about a quarter of the Scottish electorate support, and it supports separation, but for its seemingly popular old-style social democratic welfare parties. The Labour Party in Scotland is not legally or institutionally a Scottish Labour Party, very much under control from Westminster. And a lot of normal Labour voters in Scotland are pretty fed up with Blairism and find it difficult. These simple folk find it difficult to distinguish, as I could distinguish, just about Blairism from Thatcherism. Many of its activists, of the Labour Party activists in Scotland, have come to find it too London-dominated, and, as I say, many former Labour voters thought it too Blairish. And I'm bound to say, which earns me no love in the Labour Party, that and I have said very loudly, that Alex Salmond's social democracy, perhaps even more discreetly democratic socialism, is genuine and not tactical. I knew him from the time when he was nearly thrown out of the old Scottish National Party for being democratic socialist rather than what we jokingly used to call a Highland Tory or radically individualist, against socialism, against the welfare state, against Europe, against the world if it wasn't wearing a kilt. And anybody who went to a Scottish National Party meeting now wearing a kilt would be regarded as a nutter. They have broken from the Kailyard tradition that is so much loved in the United States, fighting back against Irish days. I don't know how it is in Australia. But will this lead to independence? I'm sure that's what you want to know, and that's what I want to know. Salmond is prepared to take his time and establish a reputation for good government in a distinctly Scottish style and some distinctively Scottish policies. Compared to nationalism and unionism confronting each other in Northern Ireland, passions are low in Scotland, even if principles are strong. But the situation is fluid, uncharted waters for the constitutionless United Kingdom constitution, or some would simply say the incomplete and uncodified constitution. The key constitutional doctrine of the United Kingdom is still widely believed, as I've said, to be the sovereignty of Parliament. The trouble with that is, as some super patriots are well aware, that Parliament can abrogate its own sovereignty in such a way that it is politically highly unlikely that it could ever reclaim it. The Conservatives realise that. It would be politically impossible for them to try to, they might tinker with it a bit, but to try to repeal the Scotland Act. The real thoughts in their mind are whether the Union will endure. I mean, that's quite clear in Britain signing up to, the way Parliament can abrogate its own sovereignty is perfectly clear in the case of signing up to the Treaty of Rome and subsequent legislation, even in Thatcher's time. But also, please, listen to this from the Northern Ireland Constitution Act, 1973, passed when Ted Heath was Conservative Prime Minister. It contains the famous guarantee to the Ulster Protestant Unionists. It is hereby declared that Northern Ireland remains part of Her Majesty's dominions and of the United Kingdom, and it is hereby affirmed that in no event will Northern Ireland or any part of it cease to be part of Her Majesty's dominions and of the United Kingdom without the consent of a majority of people in Northern Ireland voting in a poll held for that purpose under this section of the Act and in accordance with Schedule 1 of this Act. Struth, crikey, what a guarantee. Northern Ireland is not constitutionally an integral and perpetual part of the United Kingdom, but a conditional one. And the British-Irish Intergovernmental Agreement of November 1985, in Thatcher's time, pledged both governments to the establishment of a United Ireland if the consent of a majority in the North was forthcoming. Set that enabled Gerry Adams, who saw the light before his own hard men, to bring round his own hard men. I meant the light that he couldn't win, but the British also saying that they couldn't win. So this very strange compromise of legislative power sharing. But British governments of both parties, authors of those pragmatic and essential moves in resolving the Irish question, see no connection between this and the Scottish question. Perhaps this is because the Scots are not thought likely to proceed through violence. In last year's election campaign for the Scottish Parliament, these are fixed term elections, by the way, Alex Salmond said something very important but so puzzling to the media in its basic simplicity that it was largely ignored. He said, "Independence is a political and not a social matter." Indeed, a political matter, if the electorate want it, ultimately they should have it and could take it politically. Constitution be damned. But not a social matter? Enigmatic. But I think that was meant to reassure voters that independence would not distance family and friends from each other, north and south of the border, nor privilege employment and office holding to true or real Scots, still less disenfranchised immigrants, amongst whom I count myself, whom Scotland badly needs, even English immigrants. Any idea in SNP thinking of an ethnic test for citizenship was long ago abandoned, well, long enough ago. Independence is indeed, compared to the old SNP concept of separation, a relative term, both economically and socially. Independence in Europe became the wily slogan, but independence in Europe is not separation and is not the power of independent activity, thanks to the laws of the European community. It's a very limited kind of independence. This makes, I believe, Gordon Brown's banging on about Britishness, which he's been doing a lot lately, some echo might have reached these shores, both mistaken and irrelevant. In a speech last year to the TUC, he used the term, according to The Guardian, 34 times. And in his speech to the Labour Party conference, the BBC counted 80 strikes of Britishness. Not always to define it, of course, that's rather difficult, but our British this and that attached to all sorts of aspirations and objects. Unfortunately, British jobs for British workers slipped out. If he was gunning for the Scottish National Party, I think it was a profoundly mistaken tactic, as I wrote to him and didn't expect a reply, a profoundly mistaken tactic to denounce, as he so often repeated, Scottish nationalism. For whereas only about a third of Scots favour separation or independence, nearly all Scots have a strong national consciousness of being Scots, both more articulate and more clear than the English have had of Englishness, until quite recently, the remarkable phenomena of the Cross of St. George suddenly floating all over the country, and a recognition, even or particularly among football crowds, that the Union Jack is not the English flag, but is the flag of the Union that does not field a football team. And the extraordinary strength of separate nationalisms in the United Kingdom, this is my real knockdown argument, is shown by the fact that FIFA allows uniquely of any state in the world the United Kingdom to field four separate football teams. My God, we'll be unbeatable if we fielded one. If we could find the right foreign coach. But my fellow English have usually confused Englishness completely with being British. Although, as I say, in the last decade, but that's another story, this is beginning to change. Anyway, Brown probably bangs on about Britishness mainly because he's worried that Middle England may think that he is too Scottish. But the trouble is, he really does seem to want us to believe that the unity of the United Kingdom is in danger in relation to immigration, not just to devolution, if there is not a stronger, widely held sense of Britishness. Listen to the mission statement, or if I may speak one word of Gaelic, the slogan, that's where the word comes from, the slogan he had drafted while he was still at the Treasury for a conference hosted by the Treasury, no less, back in November 2005. How British do we feel? What do we mean by Britishness? These questions are increasingly important in defining a shared purpose across all of our society. The strength of our communities, the way we understand diversity, the vigour of our public services and our commercial competitiveness all round the rest of the world rest on a sense of what Britishness is and how it sets shared goals. Mr. Chairman, may I very impudently or imprudently read this again, just altering one word? How Australian do we feel? What do we mean by Australianness? These questions are increasingly important in defining a shared purpose across all of our society. The strength of our communities, the way we understand the diversity, the vigour of our public services and our commercial competitiveness all rest on a sense of what Australianness is and how it sets shared goals. I think your late Prime Minister would, well, used that kind of language very frequently, did he not? I'll come to that right at the end. Do each of us really need a shared, each of our countries really need a shared, an explicit shared purpose and shared goals. I think such language is a tired rhetorical echo of the old destructive nationalisms of Central Europe and even the modern Balkans. Is this really how states hold together, especially in the modern world of, whether we like it or not, a global economy, where all notions of national sovereignty need to be so qualified as to be practically useless in understanding actual international relations? This idea of national purpose, to my mind, is what Goethe called a blue rose. To search for it can prove damaging as well as frustrating. Both Thatcher and Blair openly spoke of restoring our British sense of national importance, put the great back into Great Britain, a hangover from the days of empire and the Second World War, which, of course, we won with a little help from the USA, the USSR, and certain countries in the Commonwealth. And this search to put the great back into Great Britain has meant the American alliance, with too few reservations made or questions asked. Is a heightened sense of Britishness or whateverness a clear national purpose needed to hold the Union together? Perhaps my country just needs good government, social justice, and a civil society. National leaders should be careful, I think, when they invoke our common values, still more if they think they can legislate for them. In July 2004, Brown gave the British Council annual lectures on Britishness and invoked values, our British values. The values I describe are, of course, to be found in many other cultures and countries. But when taken together, and as they shape the institutions of our country, these values and qualities, being creative, adaptable, and outward-looking, our belief in liberty, duty, and fair play, add up to a distinctive Britishness that has been manifest throughout our history and shaped it. Liberty, duty, and fair play. Well, some Scots are beginning to play cricket of a kind, but no need to feel worried. By such banalities and abstractions, I think my party leader plants both feet firmly in midair. Worse, when Brown gives specific historical examples, they are all, yes, all, some patient political scientist has been through his speeches, all the examples he gives are taken from English history. Nary a one from Scotch history, not even the Declaration of Arbroath. He clearly wants us to believe that a heightened Britishness is necessary to hold the Union together, rather than a rational calculation of mutual interest and advantage, as Adam Smith would have seen it, or as David Hume would have it, tradition and habit. So he attacks the SNP in Scotland with the wrong weapons. He plays into their hands by confusing nationalism as tradition and national consciousness with nationalism as separatism. If there is a threat to the Union, I agree with the writer Neil Esherson, and even with Tom Nairn, if it's possible to pin Tom down to what he is saying, that it's less likely to come from the Scottish electorate than from English insensitivity or even provocation if, as is quite possible, the Conservatives get back in. Two of Brown's colleagues put the matter better than he in a recent Fabian pamphlet neatly called A Common Place. Said Ruth Kelly and Liam Byrne, Britishness is like an umbrella under which different identities can shelter. That's a good, homely metaphor. I think the speechwriter had borrowed it from me, as I've been, for very odd reasons, rather fond of the umbrella metaphor. But Brown speaks as if his British brolly can only shelter one identity. And the trouble is, I'm sure he doesn't really believe that. He's almost denying his own identity, or his own double identity. Well, leaders should say what they really believe if they're to be truly respected and trusted. I hope I'm, and I hope you're all not in for a disillusion, but I think I heard a fool speech by a Prime Minister the other day who did seem to be saying what he believed. Penultimately, let me return to Alex Salmond's remark about independence being a political and not a social matter. Some years ago, I was waiting in the corridor of the House of Commons for a clerk of the House of Commons, and Alex Salmond passed by, saw me, and asked me in good humour if I would return to England when Scotland gets its independence. I said to him that I would probably have voted against independence in the final referendum, probably, but would then want to be near the head of the queue at the passport office in Glasgow to get a Scottish passport. He expressed pleasure and surprise. Well, I said, I don't believe that independence can bring all the good that some hope for, nor all the troubles that others fear. And he laughed loudly. I may be imagining, and I shouldn't attribute motives to a politician's laughter, but it sounded to me more like a laugh of recognition than a mocking laugh, what Bertolt Brecht, of all people, once called the laughter of free men. Significant social and economic interrelations most often usually survive such separations, both nationally and domestically. As with the educated East of Ireland, and England and Scotland, much greater sense of ease and commonness than the educated Irish of the East feel towards the North. And they'll say that themselves in private. Finally, let me say how honoured I've been at this invitation, and also how flattered that in a speech mainly on Australian identity, addressing the National Press Club here in the Parliament House on the 25th of January 2006, the then Prime Minister Howard seemed to prophesy my modest coming. He said, I believe in our unique democracy because I believe passionately in the virtue of politics. The political philosopher, Bernard Crick, put it well when he said, the moral consensus in a free state is not something mysteriously prior to or above politics. It is the activity, the civilizing activity of politics itself. Gosh, I was brilliant when I was young. But unfortunately, I must in all honesty draw from what he quoted a rather different conclusion than he did. For I believe that the cohesion of states like Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom depends not on the state attempting to define and heighten national feeling, but more simply on maintaining a just and caring democratic politics and perhaps working together, working towards over time a much more civic or citizenship culture. I think it depends much more on that, so that immigrants may come to like it and identify with the national spirit, a spirit that can grow on one over time rather than by taking a particular test, and be strongly felt but is best left undefined, particularly by prime ministers snatching for strong straws.
We have some time for some questions. Could I ask the questions to go to the microphones if they can, to up here, to up the right there. Now, while Malcolm was tediously making his way to the microphone, Can I just interpose a quick question? Gordon Brown's been carrying on about written constitutions and bills of rights and constitutional reform and parliaments being able to agree before we go to war and things. What's all that about? What's led to that?
I'm not sure. He's talking the talk, but as we say, will he walk the walk? And I've grave doubts about this. There's a great deal of talk from Labour ministers, and I think it's a shadow of their old beliefs and their old roots, not the socialists, but so much as the democratic values. They talk a great deal now about trying to increase participation in the community, but they are not talking about regional government. They're not talking about restoring powers to local governments. So it's difficult to know what they're talking about. After all, I say to people, damn it, a centralised regime of over 50 million people, this is England without Scotland and Wales, there's hardly a state, well, apart from China and South and North Korea, that tries to govern so many people centrally without some form of radical devolution or some form of federalism. That interests me here in Australia and interests me historically that the Brits felt this about the colonies but never felt it about themselves. I just don't know. They're going to try and pour millions into community participation, but they are looking at, as I say, trying to do this centrally over a country of 50 million. I don't really believe it can be done. In the very early years of the Labour government, after all, the committee that I have the honour to chair that brought citizenship into English schools as a compulsory subject, that was based on active citizenship rather than good citizenship. Thank God the public thought it was all about good citizenship, what I believe you call nice Nellyism, about behaving well. Well, I'm all for good behaviour, I'm all for good citizenship, but we went beyond that and said, no, active citizenship. Well, that's there in the schools, but perhaps the next generation may think differently, but the structures through which kids with a participative urge, we hope, when they come into voting age, the structures into which they can enter are rather limited.
Yeah, now, Malcolm, yes.
My question is this. A former Prime Minister of ours, Paul Keating, made a remark during the 1996 election that when the government changes, the country changes. And ever since that remark, it's been treated as though it was the ultimate wisdom by all sorts of political pundits and so forth. Even to the point where John Howard asserted this proposition during the re-election of 2007. Do you think it's true or sensible to say that when the government of a country changes, the country changes?
No. I mean, not if one means by country the totality of society. I mean, certain key policies may change, but no. And when the Kennedys came in the States. I was in the States as a young man, I think the year when Kennedy came in. There had been Harry Truman and his wife and daughter who had nice, round, chubby faces. And suddenly, with John Kennedy's wife, all women seemed to have long, fine-boned features, certain types come forward and are more apparent. Well, with changes of government, yes, you then get encouragement. But, you see, you get so... I'm always trying to argue with my academic colleagues who actually agree with me, but I'm arguing with them that we should say with a very loud voice that if you're talking about changing values, well, why not? If morally you think values should change, why not? But you're talking about generational change. You're not talking about parliamentary timetables. This is what irritates me when party leaders start talking about changing values. All the evidence that we know show that the changes of values are very slow and generational.
Yeah, now, this is not going to be a Scottish question, is it?
Well, it started out in my original thinking, and I had been reading the Scottish story with Scottish history. Mm. So I came here primed, and what did I hear? I heard Erin Gabrah. It was the Gaelic from Scotland, of course, but I use this constantly myself, Erin Gabrah, because of my origins. My people came here 1835. Mm. I've yet to find a government that suits me. Well, how about turning that back on yourself? Have you got a government? And I'm talking, every government we've had has yet to achieve a thing that I call Australian, and our Speaker gave it to us. Do we speak Australian? As the Scots undoubtedly do. Now, I want to give you two clues, and whether you cope with them or not, this will be the Australian story.
What about a question?
My words are Kerry Packer. I want to say Kerry Packer broke the mould. Now, the Speaker may not know Kerry Packer. We do.
Aye, we have heard of him.
And, well, now, Kerry Packer was the Australian I look to. I'd like to know, will we have somebody in our future or in Scottish future that'll be like Kerry Packer?
Perish the thought. So, sorry, you answer, not me.
All I'd say about Erin Gabrah, Ireland must be free if you're looking for the ideal state. You see, about a quarter of those who vote for Sinn Féin and are Catholic in Northern Ireland still say they favour the union. Now, I think really they favour the unity of Ireland, but they want to know what's in the package, like the Scots in 1707. They're not mad nationalists, my country right or wrong, you know, Ireland shall be united whatever the cost. I mean, they're family men and they're sensible people. They're sort of thinking in practical, pragmatic terms. If the terms of a union are good terms, they will take them. But still, you're not going to find an ideal government, except where we don't know much about the government of heaven, but we have our suspicions.
What about Kerry Packer?
Well, wasn't he the man who started cricket teams playing in coloured uniforms?
Yes.
I find myself very English at that point.
Now, another question. Sound?
What's sorry. I've got a question about language also. There's been some controversy recently about the rather expensive digital TV that's just been announced for Gaelic, Scottish Gaelic, and I just wondered, I know Welsh is very important for the Welsh identity. I just wondered if you had a few words about the role of Gaelic.
No, I think I share the view of my Scottish friends that it's a pity to see an old culture vanish. In the way that you have the cultural debate here about indigenous or aborigine culture, and a very difficult debate it is, because it's on actually helping people live in a way that is not compatible with modern health and the modern world, or is one. But this doesn't arise in Scotland in a sense, because the Gaels are living in a perfect, the Gaelic speakers are living in a perfectly normal way, and they're nearly all bilingual anyway, so it's a question of preserving language, so it's a question of how much expense it's worth it. So there's a sort of pragmatic political argument. In Wales it is rather different, because there was a panic way back in Macmillan and Heath's time in the late 50s and 60s when the Plaid Cymru, the Party of Wales, when they began to displace Labour and Liberals in Wales, and they got 6 or 7 seats. And to put it very crudely, I think they were bought off with massive subventions for Welsh television, legislation allowing county by county votes, so that half the education in schools, half the subjects could be taught in Welsh. The other half had to be taught in English, but the half could be taught in Wales. And I remember an old leader of the Welsh nationalists saying to some of us at a conference in the bar, admittedly, saying, he said, you know, Bernard, the trouble with most of my fellow countrymen is that they, most of my fellow party members in the Plaid is that they cannot count. You see, because if we had independence, there are a majority of non-Welsh speakers, and they would not stand for all this stuff in the courts and Parliament of having to speak Welsh. I think the Welsh, actually at heart, the Welsh nationalists have got what they want, in a sense of a massive protection of the language. And you see, this is one funny old thing. I mustn't go off on this, because I had a hand in, oh dear, the new immigration tests in Britain. But the statute stated, as the old statute stated, that there must be a test conducted in English, Welsh or Scottish Gaelic. Gosh, there was a rumour 2 years ago, and I think I know who started it, a witty member of my old committee, a Muslim Welsh woman, claimed that somebody had turned up wanting to be examined in Welsh, so that the new government of Wales, who were tremendously strong on bilingualism, were in an absolute panic because nobody had thought of translating the immigration tests. And what is more, the bloody 68-page handbook, you know, nobody had thought, but fortunately that, no, sorry, I'm joking, but there is that. See, that's part of a multicultural society, is already, to get back to the Scottish thing, is already dug in there in statute, in political terms, in Scottish Gaelic is quite unimportant. Although, not surprising, the Gaelic speakers tend to vote nationalist. But it's only in very small, very thinly populated areas of the Highlands and Islands.
Very quick last question.
Any proposals for devolution in England dead, especially after the failure of the ham-fisted referendum in North East England?
No. I think not, alas. I think the Deputy Prime Minister, who did believe very strongly in devolution, I think he was just hung out to dry by his colleagues, to be absolutely blunt. And there wasn't a concerted government campaign in favour of, you see, let's try it on the North East first, or even the North East, who do have, I think, a stronger sense of identity than some of the administrative English regions. After all, there are six regions, you see, administratively. But it's not a real question politically. An idea of the early study of Parliament Group in 1972, I was talking to the Australian group the other night, was that there should be regional committees of the House of Commons. And very surprisingly, this was revived last year by the government, I think desperate to make some sense of talking about devolving powers without actually devolving very much power. So there would be these Westminster committees. It was all drawn up. The clerks were nearly going bananas about how to do it, because on parliamentary rules you have to have, a governing party majority on each committee. Well, what self-respecting Conservative would want to serve on the North Eastern Committee? And what self-respecting Geordie or MP for Newcastle would want to go down in the South East? You know, these committees could have just been an endless source of trouble. They were supposed to be looking at regional administration. But then when you look at English regional administration, many of the boundaries are not the same for different functions of government. So you've got a lot of civil servants out in the regions, but the practical difficulties, and also the difficulties, I think, of manning these committees and getting political balance, meant the whole scheme was pulled at literally at 24 hours notice. So it is the theoretical solution. My old friend John McIntosh, passionate for Scottish devolution in the early 1970s, when there was very little public opinion behind it, he tried to answer the West Lothian question, which actually I've rather sheared off, by saying, well, if there were elected regions in England, it would be much easier to tolerate Scotland having its own reserve powers. He published a penguin book about it. It's a curiosity now. It isn't a real... There seems to be no strong regional sentiment in England behind it. It's a theoretical answer, but it's not... It's not practical politics, alas. I'm thinking of stuff I wrote advocating regional government in England in the 70s. I'm embarrassed at it now.
On that note, it's a good note to end. Would you join me in thanking our lecturer?
Oh,